Welcome back to the second half hour of The Source on KSTX 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. The great Ivy-covered universities of America, Harvard, Yale, Columbia, Brown. These are bastions of liberalism, right? They helped shape the intellectual arguments for the expansion of civil rights and even the abolition of slavery. But there's more to that. Much more. Another history of the great university says how they owe their existence to the slave trade and how slavery was once a part of daily life on campus. The history is told by MIT professor Craig Stephen Wilder in his new book, Ebony and Ivy. Professor Wilder, welcome to The Source.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Our phone lines are open. If you want to join the conversation, the number is 614-8980, 614-8980. So many people look at these great universities and think that they are they don't think about the connection with slavery. This is actually, was this a hidden history? Is this something that had been kind of covered up and forgotten about?
Yeah, I think it was, you know, hidden in some ways in plain sight. The archives of these universities, the libraries, are actually filled with information about their early histories. And I think a lot of the historians, a lot of the scholars who actually looked at the history and wrote the history of these institutions in the late 19th century and in the early 20th century came across much of the same evidence that I did. Some of it was included, often not in a way that's sort of balanced or sensitive. And, you know, some of it was erased. It was just sort of skipped over. And there were different strategies for doing that. But and so I think since the 2006 report from Brown University on its relationship to the slave trade and slavery at its founding, there's been a renewed interest in this subject.
But there's been a lot written about these universities over the years, and they love to regurgitate their own history all the time, but yeah. Somehow this is something that they forget to mention.
Yeah, you know, I think you're absolutely right that, you know, there's a tendency to see these institutions, and I shared it for a long time as, you know, benign, as sort of benevolent institutions in American society. And when you find the presence of an enslaved person on campus, for instance, or the presence of multiple enslaved people on campus, it's easy to believe, to convince oneself, that that's actually kind of accidental, that it's just a consequence of the fact that these institutions emerged in a society with slavery, but that they weren't themselves dependent upon or pursuing that slave economy.
So your book, Ebony and Ivy, isn't just about the universities, but it's about the story of America and how slavery, it was the bondage of slavery and the profits of slavery, where it was founded the nation and put the nation on its profitable path through when it was colonial enterprise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's actually a perfect way of describing it. In many ways, if the story of slavery on campus, if the story of the relationship between colleges and the slave trade and the presence of enslaved people and even the founding moments of these elite institutions, if that's a surprise to people, then in many ways, actually, what they should think about is that that story parallels the story of the rise of the British colonies in North America and ultimately the rise of the United States, that slavery is part of that history. And I think campuses, colleges become extraordinarily insightful spots for investigating the universality of slavery in the early American experience.
So you spent 10 years working on this book. This is definitely not just a one-off, I'm going to knock out a quick book that you see sometimes from people. I'm going to regurgitate all my... No, this is a definite... You went out, you went to the original sources, you found new things, you put it all together in a great story, telling the story of America and including the elements of what slavery was all about. Why put 10 years of your life into this one book?
Well, thank you. I think, it was. It was just over a decade. And, you know, I think several years ago, and I had said the Brown Report. When the Brown Report came out in 2006, I was already actually about 3 or 4 years into this project, 4 years into the project. And at that moment, I was honestly thinking about stopping. I did not want to go any further. You know, I realized just how big this was, how complicated it was, and how much time it was going to take. And the Brown Report came out. And I think President Ruth Simmons of Brown, the former president who commissioned the report, was so extraordinary in her articulation of the academic obligation to simply pursue the truth. And that if there were rumors about Brown's relationship to the slave trade, her response was that we have a moral obligation to vet those rumors and to just make public our own history in much the same way that we constantly investigate and interrogate the histories of other institutions. And, you know, I was so moved by both the quality of that report and the honesty of it that I just felt I, you know, had to push on, and I decided to give it another year. And then another year became another two, and another two became, you know, seven, and we get where we are today.
You start out not talking about or writing about the African-American slave issue, but mm-hmm. you start even earlier than that with the Native American involvement with these universities, that they were mm-hmm. Bringing in Native Americans to be schooled and educated.
Right.
And that plays into the overall arc. Why start there?
I think in many ways I wanted to start there because the story of the relationship between colleges and slavery, their dependence upon the slave trade as a source of funds, and their use of enslaved labor on campus, doesn't make full sense until you actually start to rethink their role in the colonial world. Or we have to break the sort of 21st and 20th century perception of universities and go back to the colonial world. And what I argue in that chapter is that colleges are very much part of the colonial enterprise. They're very much part of the colonial garrison. They have specific responsibilities, and one of the responsibilities is to spread the gospel on behalf of the different nations that are colonizing in North America, to bring Native people to these religious traditions and to send out missionaries to them. And so the early colleges are raising money in Europe, and particularly in Britain, to evangelize Native Americans. The first brick building at Harvard is the Indian College. At William & Mary, money is raised to establish Brafferton Hall, this extraordinary structure that sits right across from the President's House. And Brafferton Hall is the original Indian College at William & Mary. And so part of the reason why those two stories connect, and I think that it was important to connect them, is that these colleges turn to the slave trade in part to underwrite the project of evangelizing Native people, to help pay for the expansion of the academy, but also for the creation, the churning out of missionaries who were sent into Indian country on behalf of these various competing colonial nations.
So the individuals of Native Americans, when they would go to the Indian College at Harvard, would they graduate fully educated, or were they just converted with, having some reading and writing skills?
Yeah, there's actually a fairly high death rate among the Indian students who study at Harvard in the 17th century. There's a young man who graduates in 1655, right after the Indian College is opened, and I believe he's the only graduate in the colonial period. There are other students who are about to graduate and either leave or pass away before they do. But, the goal is actually to graduate them, to train them, often to train them as ministers, and then send them back into their own nations as missionaries and ministers of the gospel.
We're going to continue this. We're going to take a quick break. We're speaking with Professor Craig Stephen Wilder, the author of Ebony and Ivy, about the African-American legacy, about the slavery legacy of the great universities. We'll be right back. This is The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies, talking about the book Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities. The author, Professor Craig Stephen Wilder, he's a professor of history at MIT. So let's talk just about how it worked. So how was it that mm-hmm. the slavery and the slave trade and the profits of the slave trade led to the foundations of these universities, or the allowing them to prosper and grow?
Sure. If you think about the Mid-Atlantic and New England colleges, there's in the period before the American Revolution, there are basically nine colleges in the British colonies in North America. The first three, Harvard, William & Mary, and Yale, are founded before 1701. Then six are founded in roughly a 25-year period, and it's between Princeton, which is founded about 1746, and Dartmouth, founded in 1769. That dramatic growth in the number of schools, a tripling of the number of schools in North American colonies, comes at the same time that the African slave trade is actually peaking in the Atlantic world. And it's the new wealth created in the port cities of New York and Philadelphia, and Providence and Newport, Rhode Island, from the Atlantic trade, from the slave trade, and from the provisioning trade, the trade of taking goods from fish to lumber to horses, from New England down to the colonies in the Carolinas, Virginia, and the West Indies. It's those trades that are actually generating the wealth that allows the colonies to begin expanding their institutional infrastructure, including colleges. And so King's College, which is now Columbia, the College of New Jersey, which is now Princeton, the College of Rhode Island, which is now Brown, all, in fact, have a significant number of traders on their board and a significant number of men engaged in the African slave trade and the provisioning trade to the plantations in the West Indies and the South.
What a lot of people don't remember is that slavery was up and down the United States that existed at the time. There wasn't the free side and the slavery side just yet.
Right.
So people had slaves, and if if you went to the university as a student, you brought yours with you. Or if you were a teacher or a governor,
there are examples of that. Yeah, you know, at William and Mary, it became fairly ordinary for the students to bring slaves to campus, and they paid additional fees to house their slaves on campus. But there are also examples of that in the North. So in the book, I point to the example of John Jackie Custis, who's George Washington's stepson, and he goes to King's College, now Columbia University in New York City, and he brings his slave Joe with him. The faculty often held slaves, and the slaves also worked in the president's houses. And so often multiple slaves would work in the president's house. John Witherspoon of Princeton, now then the College of New Jersey, had at least two slaves working in both the president's house on campus and where he used in his private home. Enslaved people are a kind of regular part of the day-to-day experience of higher education in the colonial world.
Slave labor was used to build the U.S. Capitol and White House. Is there any... did they build structure? Was there slave? Did slaves build any of the structures that are there today?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, and the analogy is perfect because I think you know we tend to think of places like the University of Virginia, Thomas Jefferson's great monument to higher education, where slave labor was used quite heavily. But one can go north easily from there. And at Dartmouth, Eliezer Wheelock, the Reverend Eliezer Wheelock, who's the founder and the first president of Dartmouth, arrives in Hanover, New Hampshire, with 8 enslaved black people, men, women, and a child. And as he puts it in his memoirs, in his narrative of his early years there, he's putting his slaves to work, helping to raise some of the structures that he'll need to begin his school, to begin his college. At the College of Rhode Island, Brown University, now the trustees actually took donations, and some of the donations came in the form of people donating the labor of their slaves to help build the school. And so that's actually, you're absolutely right. That's an ordinary part of the raising of the institutional infrastructure in the American colonies, and certainly true of colleges, too.
Now, what about the curriculum that was taught at these schools? Was that something that would reinforce the idea of slavery? You said these are religious institutions at their heart.
Yeah, they are. Especially in the colonial period, they're very much religious institutions. Although, remember, they're also preparing the young men who will come to take over the governance of the colonies very often, and who will govern over the slave economy of the Atlantic world. You know, Harvard, William and Mary, and Yale are not just graduating young men who are becoming ministers. You know, a lot of the students don't become ministers. Thomas Jefferson doesn't become a minister, and a lot of the young men who go don't. Many of them actually enter into the merchant economy. And I'm thinking of young men like the Livingstons, William and Philip, and of New York. Philip Livingston, in particular, graduates in the early 18th century.
But weren't they taught that slavery was a natural order of things, and that with white supremacy, and that the African people were inferior?
Well, this is something I actually explore in the book, and one of the reasons why I take the time to do it is to show that, you know, those ideas actually emerge over time, and it takes a lot of time for them to emerge, that there's a real contest about the morality of slavery, both within the colonies and on campus. You know, there's an anti-slavery debate that's happening at the time of the American Revolution, and a lot of that debate is happening on campus, and on campuses that were actually intimately tied financially to the slave trade and to slavery. And so you do have this very real tension about the morality of slavery and the place of slavery in the colonies and then in the emerging nation. And so I think you're right that one of the campus is a site in which these ideas are explored. And later in the book, I point out that in part because of their financial relationships to slavery, colleges increasingly become sites that produce these racist ideas, that refine them. And produce is probably the wrong word. It's actually that they refine them. And they give them a kind of academic and intellectual legitimacy that becomes important to 19th century debates on slavery and its morality.
So today, these universities, are they ready to self-examine? Are they ready to deal with this?
I think they are. I think they are. And I think, you know, one of the things that I found interesting in a decade of doing this research is that, when I first started doing it, I wasn't quite sure if I should tell the archivist what I was working on. And so I very often just say I'm working on, you know, 18th century education. And by the second half of the project, the last 5 years, I was much more open about what I was working on, and in part because since the Brown Report and a little bit before, you know, the universities have begun to start exploring this history themselves down at Emory in Atlanta, at William and Mary in Virginia, at Brown, obviously. But a lot of campuses have actually begun to explore this history themselves. And really, even at the level of the trustees, if you think about institutions like the University of Alabama with the faculty vote, have begun to actually take responsibility for this history and take responsibility for making it public and responding to it.
And what does that mean for the descendants of slaves?
I'm not sure ultimately. I think we have to let it play out. But one of the reasons I wrote the book, and I hope that one of the reasons I wrote it the way I wrote it, is that, you know, it's always important to me as a historian to make sure I treat the histories and the legacies and the lives of enslaved people with the respect that they deserve. And hiding their experiences on campus does them no service at all. In fact, it does them an insult. And so I really wanted to bring that history forward. And in the end, I don't think that threatens these institutions at all. I think it actually ends up making it stronger. I think Brown, after 2006, has become a university that showed remarkable leadership and courage and grace in a difficult moment, and actually gave its peer institutions a model for how to respond to this challenge.
So Brown created a whole new center of slavery as a result of their study. So they're
right.
Doing that. But that's an academic enterprise. But there are, you know, people of African American, the slaves, descendants, that would love to have a chance to go to one of these universities, and it's just not possible.
Well, you know, they also did things like, on the recommendation of the committee, they've done things like actually turn to look at, to begin developing scholarships and other ways of really responding more three-dimensionally to it. So it's not just academic. They're actually taking real policy steps. And I don't think there's any one prescription for every institution. You know, I think that Dartmouth, for instance, has a history with both Native Americans and with African Americans that are very different, but also that both need a response. And Columbia has a different challenge from Dartmouth, and Princeton has a different challenge from Yale. But what I do hope is that these institutions will stop being afraid of the things that are in their libraries and archives. There's nothing there that's going to ruin them. But there is a chance to really be more open, more honest about their past, and to have a more informed debate about their future.
What kind of role do you think your book, Ebony and Ivory, is going to have on the national conversation about race that we need to have?
I think it's exactly that. I think it's that, you know, my hope is that we'll have an open, honest conversation. I think we can discuss. We're a nation and a people who are capable of discussing even the most difficult issues, but that discussion needs to be informed. And it should be informed by, you know, the most complex understanding of our past as possible. And so my hope is to just provide people with a bit more information about how we came to be as a nation and the sacrifices that we all made to produce this nation.
And it wasn't just universities. There were plenty of multinational corporations that exist today that can trace their roots back to these days, and they need to have these conversations also.
Yeah. Insurance companies and banks and universities and churches. And, yeah, you know, some of them show up in the book, but there's a lot of work left to be done to produce the whole network of institutions that undergirded the slave trade.
It was great talking with you, Professor Craig Stephen Wilder, author of Ebony and Ivy, The Slave, Race, Slave, and the Troubled History of American Universities. This is The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. Thank you so much for tuning us in.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. David Martin Davies is executive producer and host. Paul Flav is the show's producer. Management and oversight comes from VP of Programming Wayne Coble. Chris Udaly is the TPR web editor. Support for The Source comes from the contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.